Hello and welcome to The Week in 60 Minutes, brought to you by Spectator TV and broadcast on Thursday, August 5th. I'm Cindy Yee, The Spectator's broadcast editor. On this week's show, pirates are back. This time, they're hacking your computer networks in return for hefty ransoms. I speak to a former CIA man and an expert who headed up the National Cybersecurity Center to find out more. But in some parts of the world, war is still physical. I'll be reflecting on what the West still doesn't understand about Afghanistan 20 years on, and hearing about why there's no such thing as the Taliban. Back home, Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer are both in Scotland. Can they outmaneuver Nicola Sturgeon? I speak to our political editors James Forsyth and Katie Balls. Also on the show, Rory Sutherland on whether Deliveroo discounts will work as bribes for vaccination, and Suzanne Moore on whether the trans weightlifter Laurel Hubbard should have competed in the women's category. Before we get going, if you enjoy what we do on Spectator TV, then subscribe to our YouTube channel for free. Click the button at the bottom of this video and then tap the bell icon to make sure you never miss an episode. And why not subscribe to the Spectator magazine too? Get 12 weeks of the magazine for just £12 and we'll give you a free £20 Amazon gift voucher, completely free. That's 3 months of the Spectator delivered to your door and available online for just £12 with a £20 Amazon voucher. Just go to spectator.co.uk/TV offer to take it up. Now, first, would you pay a ransom to hackers? Russian gangs are increasingly targeting Western companies and institutions with cyber attacks, stealing their data and in some cases demanding millions to give it back. In this week's cover piece, Kieran Martin, formerly the chair of the National Cybersecurity Center, says we need to have a crackdown. To discuss, Kieran, who is now professor of practice at the University of Oxford, joins me with Bob Bigman, the former Chief Information Security Officer at the CIA, who now runs the security company 2BSecure. Kieran, Bob, thanks for coming on today. Now, Kieran, first, can you tell us in layman's terms, what exactly is ransomware and how does it work?
Ransomware is digital extortion. So you get extorted in one or both of two ways. Firstly, hackers lock you out of your network. So, for example, in the case of the Federation of 50 London schools, they couldn't get into the network, they couldn't pay any suppliers, they couldn't pay any invoices, but also some schools couldn't actually open because the gates and doors were internet controlled and they were locked out of that network. So the ransom demand is you will not be allowed back into the network until you pay us. And that's what you might call classic ransomware. As people's backups have improved, the utility of that has declined a bit. So a second form of extortion is they then steal some data, perhaps all of it. They will send you back something they will deem sensitive and something you'd be worried about, and they'll say, we're going to publish this online. So in the case of the Irish healthcare crisis, where the Irish health body was subject to a ransomware attack, as well as locking them out of the system, they threatened to post patient data online, for example. So those are the two ways in which you get extorted. It's been around for years, but it started really to tick up about 2 years ago. Demands got bigger, more and more companies paid, but it tended to be a slightly invisible problem. Companies paid large amounts in secret. What's happened in 2021 is that due to a number of factors, including the increasing recklessness and cockiness of the hackers, they've started to have really dangerous consequences that have worried policymakers all the way up to the US president. So one attack took out a pipeline on the east coast of the US, leading to fuel shortages. We've dealt with the Irish healthcare crisis. As we speak, you can't book a vaccine around the greater Rome area because the Italian vaccination booking system has been ransomwared. School attacks in England and New Zealand, attacks on food retail in Sweden, etc. So the real world consequences of this have become much, much more visible, much more problematic and much more dangerous.
And these hackers, they're in it for money, are they? They're not in it for geopolitical reasons. They're looking for literally fast cash.
In my view, these people have no political objectives whatsoever. They just want money. They are completely amoral. All they want is cash, or cryptocurrency more accurately.
Yes. And Bob, do you see a similar thing happening in America as well, given that Biden is clearly interested in it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's all about cash. It's all about making a fast buck and moving on to the next target. And again, the targets have no association with any industrial or corporate or geopolitical point. It's hospitals, it's banks, it's all sorts of organizations, and we've had great impact here in the U.S. as he mentioned. We also had a death also associated with a ransomware attack as well.
How so?
Well, so a hospital who was ransomwared basically had certain services open for a patient who was sent there in an emergency. They couldn't use the emergency room services because they had been ransomwared and they had locked up that portion of the network. They tried to move the individual to another hospital, but because they were in a rural area, it took another 40-45 minutes until they can move them to another hospital. In the meantime, on their way there, the patient died.
Yeah, gosh, that's shocking. Kieran, who are these people? We say that they're not political. Are they just kids in their basements? Or are they organized criminals? Or are they state-sponsored, even if it's the mission is not political?
They're organized criminals and they're state-tolerated. You wouldn't set up a ransomware operation of the size and scale that we're now seeing in the US. You wouldn't set it up in the UK. You wouldn't set it up in most of European Union countries because law enforcement would kick the door down within a month or so. The Russian state and some other former Soviet republics tend to dominate the hosting of these criminals. You could see it in some respects as the latest sort of manifestation of Russian organized crime. And there's an implicit deal between the Russian state and the Russian criminal groups, which is don't attack Russians and Russian interests. So, for example, a lot of the malicious code that you see is designed not to attack networks that have installed Russian language keyboards, which is really interesting and telling. And occasionally the state will come and say, look, so-and-so is a very good hacker. They need to come and work for the government. And occasionally, but this is what we need to increase, they do something so embarrassing and so reckless and difficult that the state puts some sort of pressure on them to sort of lie low, or occasionally will organise a sort of pantomime show trial. But in effect, this is not directed by the Russian state, but until quite recently, until, for example, President Biden saw fit to raise it near the top of his agenda with President Putin, there's been no cost to the Putin regime of tolerating this. It brings in money, it keeps quite dangerous people occupied in a way that doesn't harm the Russian state. It irritates the West, which is no bad thing from their point of view. But it's not to be confused with the sort of Russian state hacks on the US, the UK and others. This is basic criminality hosted in and around Russia.
And Bob, is there anything that governments can do about being victims of hacks? Obviously, we're talking about businesses that are mainly the victims, but is there anything that their governments, the American and the UK governments, can do back? Can we hack back, for example? Is that a thing that people can do?
Well, you can hack back. I think it's a horrible idea. I don't think, other than just recently, these incidents have reached a national security level. They seem to be now just touching on the edges, right, of national security. The Colonial Pipeline attack was clearly one that hit the infrastructure that could impact the national security of the U.S. and did for a short time. But you can see they certainly stepped back from that, and the Russian government was quite embarrassed internally after that incident. They're going to try to solve it from a geopolicy perspective, right, and try to develop international norms and standards, somewhat like we did to the in the nuclear arms race with mutual assured destruction. I don't know if that's going to actually work. I have my doubts. But short of that, I really don't know what can be done at a national policy or global policy level. I think this has to be worked out in different ways.
And Bob, Kieran writes in his piece that you as a business owner, you shouldn't pay these ransoms. What do you think about that? I mean, it seems like the fast way to make the problem go away.
Well, but in fact, it doesn't. I would love that to be the national policy and have it enforced as well. But that's not reality. I work with these companies every day and help them build, cyber programs, and they still get hacked. They still get ransomwared. And they're not part of the global geopolitical fight on cyber war, right? They're trying to make things, sell things, do things for people, and make a profit. It's all about their business. And what's important to them is not what part of the national struggle they are. They're actually trying to make make money. And for them, it's the fastest way is to get back up in business, and it's to go to the Bitcoin machine and pay your dues and hope you don't get hit again.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously there have been a small number of stories about people being hit twice as well.
Yeah, I haven't seen that myself. I, as I said, I think, you know, there's some are just really unlucky, and that different gangs basically have just targeted that same company more than once. But there's no master list, you know, that they all work from.
Yeah. And Kieran, on cryptocurrency, because that's often the medium of choice for these criminals because it's untraceable. I mean, there's nothing we can do about cryptocurrency, right? As now in the world, it's being speculated upon in the stock market. It's this decentralized currency system. And once it's in the world, we can't eradicate it. It will still be here and the criminals will continue using it. So there's nothing. Can we do anything about that part of things?
I don't claim to be an expert on cryptocurrency, but a number of cybersecurity.
I don't think anyone is an expert on cryptocurrency.
Still struggle to work out the whole point of it, but that's a completely different podcast or a different episode of Spectator TV. I think, but some cybersecurity experts and some people with expertise in cryptocurrency would say that there is more that can be done. So, for example, the US Treasury has had for more than 6 months now a draft rule which has not yet been imposed on so-called Know Your Customer requirements. In other words, for any transaction, I think the figure is $10,000. You have to ascertain some form of verifiable identity before the money is transferred under US law. Now, clearly, there are all sorts of loopholes, and to implement that effectively would require coordination. But that's the sort of thing that we should be looking at. I think there's a wider point just on the point on the efficacy of paying ransoms, and I completely agree with Bob that it doesn't solve the problem. And I think one of the most important things that we need to start getting through in terms of the narrative to victims and potential victims is that we need to avoid this pro-criminal narrative that ransomware is always and everywhere an existential threat, that if you don't pay, you go out of business. That narrative really suits the criminals. And the reality is, it's often more complicated than that. If you look at that case of the Harris Federation of 50 London schools, they were asked for $4 million, which they couldn't afford. They didn't pay. They undertook painstaking recovery. It was really expensive, but the total bill in US dollar term was less than $1 million. So just never mind the morality, never mind the fact that paying ransoms fuels more ransomware demands. Just as a business decision, it was cheaper just to recover.
So it is possible to recover that without paying the ransom. So that's
sometimes, and it's complicated, but it's not always and everywhere pay up or go out of business. And we need to stop saying that, because that suits the criminals. That narrative is what they want people to think.
Kieran Martin, Bob Bigman, thanks for joining Spectator TV. Now, from a new war to an old one, the West mission in Afghanistan was clearly a failure. But what exactly went wrong? As former British defence ministers campaign for greater support of Afghans who helped the war effort, Andy Owen, a former intelligence officer who spent time in the country, writes in this week's issue that the West never understood Afghanistan enough. He joins me on Spectator TV now, together with Dr. Mike Martin, who spent 2 years as a British Army officer in Helmand. Andy, Mike, thanks for coming on. Now, Andy, you write about the lessons we learned from our war in Afghanistan, and that when you were there, you saw there was no clear or measurable strategy. What was that like on the ground?
Before sort of we answer about strategy, I think when we're talking about Afghanistan at the moment, it's really important to recognise the 40,000 at least Afghan civilians who've died, the 3,500 coalition troops, 450 of them British who died, as well as the acts of bravery that were committed there as well, and recognise that it is really tough to talk about the failures, because certainly the relatives who had loved ones who have died there do not want to feel that they died in vain. But it is really important to recognise the failures, and we owe it to the next generation of soldiers and the next generation of civilians who may be impacted if we make the same mistakes again. And for me, one of the biggest mistakes was that lack of a clear, measurable, consistent strategy on the ground in Afghanistan. And there's one good example to illustrate that was one day sitting in the headquarters of the coalition down in Helmand, in Lashkar Gah, The brigade commander had been visiting a district only the day before and had been talking to some of the farmers there who were growing opium. And he had assured them he wasn't interested in their opium. He was interested in dealing with the Taliban there. And if they didn't support the Taliban, he wouldn't touch their opium. And then the next day, when we were sitting there, a task force from Kabul flew down in their white Hind helicopters, landed, sponsored by the Foreign Office, and destroyed the opium crop there because they were part of the counter-narcotics task force. And our strategy at different points was focused on trying to originally get rid of the architects behind 9/11. It was then also trying to get rid of the Taliban. It was dealing with the opium problem there, trying to cut off the opium supplies. And then ultimately, sort of driven by a flawed and hubristic ideology, trying to give the non-existent nation state of Afghanistan a Western liberal democracy and supplant that on a very different culture that had its own system of governance and really a very local, tribal-based way of interacting.
And Mike, this is something that you've picked up on as well. In the past, you've written about how the West was funneling money into the Afghan government as well as into the Pakistan government. And you point out that this is a ridiculous strategy. Can you talk us through why that's so contradictory?
Sure. Well, obviously Afghanistan and Pakistan are neighbours and they share a border that the Brits, in fact, drew in 1893. And it's pretty commonly accepted that the Pakistani government and particularly the Pakistani military support the Afghan Taliban, and they support them militarily with supplies, but also with advisors and with a rest area. You know, you can go back across the border, your family are safe, perhaps you can go to hospital if you've been injured. So, you know, the Pakistani state, we need to be very clear, are a major supporter of the Afghan Taliban. Now, of course, Pakistan is a poor country and it's also a strategic and important country. And so over the last 50 years, but let's just deal with it since 9/11, over the last 20 years, America and the Brits and other countries have funneled billions of dollars into Pakistan in the way of, you know, development projects, but also in the way of kind of arms deals. So we've sold them weapons and we've given them weapons. And some of that is because they've been conducting operations in their own countries. But of course, there is inevitably leakage. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to come back to the point of your question, we have spent the last 20 years in Afghanistan supporting the Afghan government to fight the Taliban, who are an insurgent movement who threaten that government. But at exactly the same time, we have been paying billions of dollars to the Pakistani government whilst they have been sending that money back across the border to the Afghan Taliban, who have then used it to blow up British soldiers. And that sounds like a very bold way of stating that, but that's exactly what has been happening. British government money, American government money has been through this cycle via the Pakistani government, via groups that we lump together and we call the Afghan Taliban, and have been blowing up British and American soldiers. And to us, that seems utterly insane. Well, to the Helmandis, where we were, where Andy and I were in the south of the country, or to the Afghans, it is beyond insane. And so they try and explain this evidence that they have in front of them. And the only way that they can explain this evidence is they come to the following conclusion. They conclude that the Brits and the Americans are working with the Pakistanis and the Taliban to destroy the Afghan state. And this sounds like a crazy conspiracy theory. Indeed, when I first heard it, I thought, wow, this is up there with, 9/11 didn't happen, or the moon landings were faked. It is a very, very, very common idea or concept that Afghans have that explains the last 20 years of the war in Afghanistan.
That's fascinating, Mike. Andy, how much do you think that the West understands what those conversations are happening on the ground between Afghan people? Like, how much is our failure down to a lack of understanding of the Afghan history, culture, and what is happening on the ground?
I think it's a very significant part of our failure. I think it. I think we had very little understanding of the underlying culture. I think if you just look at how difficult it was to even communicate with the people we were interacting with, very, very few people spoke the local language, Pashtun, down there. We struggled to find military interpreters. I think we'll struggle to find military interpreters again in the future because of the way we've treated some of the Afghans who did work for us. And we didn't understand the many, many local conflicts that we were getting involved in. There was some of the wider strategy that Mike has very clearly outlined there that I think we were ignorant to, but also on a very local level, we were sucked into many, many local feuds, pre-existing feuds that were fighting and bubbling away way before we got there. And we were walking into an environment we didn't understand and a conflict we didn't understand. And I think at the end of the day, we were fighting a different war to many of the Afghans who were on the ground there were fighting.
And Mike, let's talk about some... Of course.
Can I just add on to that? Would that be okay? Because I was one of the few people who spoke fluent Pashto. And I was a political officer and so my job was to try and figure some of this stuff out. And I... went just to illustrate and reinforce Andy's point. I went to the British Library to pull up the records of the British political officers who, of course, were operating in Kandahar and in Helmand throughout the 1800s. And this was in 2011. I did this. This was for the research for my PhD. So as these records came up from the stacks, I just casually asked the librarian the last time they'd been. When was the last time someone pulled these out? 1992 was the answer. And so at that point, the UK had been in Afghanistan for 10 years and we'd been in Helmand for 5 or 6 years. And nobody had bothered to go the 5 tube stops between where the MOD main building is and where the British Library is in order to do some of the research from the previous British contingents who'd been in Helmand. And of course that, you think 1800s, got this ages ago, who remembers that? Well, we didn't remember any of it, but the Helmandis, who are, well, more than half of Helmandis are illiterate. When we went there, it was about 10% literacy. They all remembered it. And they all knew who fought the British at that time. And in fact, they revered the leaders who led the rebellions, if we can call them that, against the British at that time. And this is how little we understood the conflict.
I think this is a very similar story across Asia as well. I'm Chinese myself. And, you know, in East Asia, I think that's a similar story of British involvement, British amnesia about what happened, but local memory as well. And Andy, on that China point, one thing that you point out in your piece is that for our next foreign engagement, and you point out that if we're going into Cold War II, that we need to understand China better. And I don't really see that many Chinese speakers around Westminster either. So I don't really think those lessons have been learned. What do you think?
No, I would agree. And I would hope, and this may sound extreme, but I would hope that at Staff College, people are learning about Confucianism. They're learning about the history of China, especially the British involvement there, which the Chinese population very much does remember, not least the Opium Wars, and really understand how the Chinese think. And I don't think we are doing that. And it's not about the traditional know your enemy so you can defeat your enemy. It's also about creating those opportunities for de-escalation and creating those opportunities to not go to war in the first place.
And Mike, finally, I couldn't have you on the show with and let you go without asking you about the Taliban. This is something that you've done a lot of writing about and how there's no such thing as the Taliban. Can you explain why there is a problem with politicians and the media and people in general talking about the Taliban?
Thanks for giving me the opportunity to do that. Not many media organisations do. I guess the Spectator is on the way up.
Thank you.
We as human beings, we use labels, right? We use them all the time. So if I say, the word government, that will mean something different depending on where you live on the planet, where you are on the left-right spectrum, for instance, right? And the reason labels are so important is because they then a concept pops into your head. And I would argue that when you say the word Taliban, most people think of the kind of previous Taliban government, the de facto government from 96 to 2001. So it's kind of a cohesive organization. They've got some ministries, they've got an army, they ban music, all that kind of Islamist stuff. They, you know, bad towards women, and women have to wear special shoes so they don't make noise. So we've got this kind of idea about what the Taliban are like. But the most important bit of that idea, I would argue, or the most dangerous bit of that idea, is that they are a cohesive organization that is able to operate in the same way as, say, I don't know, the Labour Party in the United Kingdom. OK,
well, arguably.
But they are. Know your audience, but they are not. They are not at all. And so I can go through maybe three ways in which they're not. There's a political office of the Taliban at the moment in Doha, and these are the guys who negotiated the agreement with the Americans in February 2020 that's led to this pullout, which is why we're having the kind of situation we've got going on now, right?
And they're the people who met the Chinese recently as well.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, this is what's dominating the news at the moment. And then we have, of course, the military wing, who are doing a lot of the fighting in Afghanistan. There's a huge amount of divergence between those two. And, you know, daily you can see statements coming from the political wing and actions coming from the military wing that are totally discordant. So it could be a ruse, but actually I think the political wing has totally lost control. Political wing are mostly from the old Taliban, from the regime 96-2001. The military wing, some of these guys, some of the fighters weren't even born when 2001 happened. Secondly, we have this idea that actually the Taliban is a kind of franchise of lots of different interest groups. And this is not hugely unusual. I mean, we do see it in political parties. You know, the Conservatives might have in them, say, free marketeers and people who are culturally conservative, for instance, right? And so, you know, the party tries to hold them together. But in the Taliban, we've got really, really marked factionalism between already established insurgent groups, so like the Haqqanis that were insurgents well before the Taliban. We've got the Helmandi Taliban, who are basically locals. They're Sanguinites, and they've got connections to Iran. We've got the guys in Kandahar. Well, they're really strongly connected to Pakistan. Up in Herat, that's a totally different thing. So we have a huge regionalization behind what we see. And then the third type of factionism I'd like to bring up is really what I explored when I was in Helmand. So as I know, as I told you, I spent some time as a political officer. I then did my PhD down there. And I picked apart all of the reasons why people were fighting. And most of the reasons why people were fighting were not to establish an Islamic Emirate. In fact, I don't think I met anyone who was that's fighting to establish an Islamic Emirate. The people were fighting because of water, or they had a feud with a police chief. And this is some of the stuff Andy was bringing up, some of the conflicts we stumbled into, or because it was a revenge killing because their brother had been killed by coalition forces, or the canal was in the wrong place, or. So there's a huge multiplicity of reasons, village to village, family to family, about why people pick up a Kalashnikov to solve their problems, because there's no effective court system in Afghanistan. So the only way you can solve your problems is with a Kalashnikov. And so we've got these three levels of factionalization between political and military, between different big factional insurgent groups in different areas of Afghanistan, and right at the micro level, between different villages, different families, different subclans. And it's really hard to call that a cohesive movement. That concept is not the same as the concepts that we described at the beginning when I said Taliban, and we thought about the 96 to 2001 Taliban with ministries and an army and so on and so forth. And the reason that's really important is because as we go forward, everyone is now saying, guys, we've got to stop fighting. We've got to sit down in Doha. The Afghan government and the Taliban have got to sit down, and they've got to hammer out some kind of transitional government or something. You know, we've got to have peace. How are we going to do this? What's the process? But how can you make peace with a movement that is so fractured? And I worry that we're hanging our hats on a process that's doomed to fail, because the Taliban, this concept of the Taliban, is not actually what we think it is.
Andy Owen, Mike Martin, thanks for joining Spectator TV. Remember, we've got a special offer if you subscribe to the magazine today. You can get 12 weeks off the magazine for just £12, and we're even throwing a free £20 Amazon gift voucher completely free. That's 3 months of The Spectator delivered to your door and available online for just £12, and you get that £20 Amazon voucher. To take it up, just go to spectator.co.uk/TV offer. Now, back home, this week, Scotland welcomes Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer as normal politics resumes. But can either man outmanoeuvre Nicola Sturgeon? I'm joined now by The Spectator's political editor, James Forsyth, and by our deputy political editor, Katie Balls. James, what's Boris Johnson's mission in Scotland?
I mean, the Prime Minister is trying to normalise him visiting Scotland. In a way, it's a symptom of what's gone wrong that a British Prime Minister visits Scotland is considered newsworthy, regardless of what he does or says on that visit. But I think this visit also gives us idea of the new phase that we're in when it comes to the debate about independence. So things have went very quiet after Holyrood elections in May. I think in the autumn, the issue will rise back up the agenda as Nicola Sturgeon tries to kind of satisfy her own activist base by moving forward on it. But I think what you're going to see is almost a nice-off between Boris Johnson and Nicola Sturgeon. I thought it was very revealing. But as soon as the news that Boris Johnson was going to Scotland leaked, Nicola Sturgeon was out with a letter to him saying, "All right, well, I hope you'll be coming to visit me so we can discuss all the shared priorities that we have." And that's because the polling that both sides are seeing shows that voters in Scotland want to see the UK government and the Scottish government working together. So you then saw Boris Johnson writing back saying, No, I'm not going to see you on this visit, but I want to see you and other first ministers in a structured forum. And then Nicola Sturgeon saying, "Well, I think it's a bit disappointing that he's come to Scotland and first chance post-COVID to sit down with me face to face and discuss shared priorities." So I think this will be a big theme of it. And I think one of the questions is that, can the UK government resist rising to every SNP provocation? I think an independence bill, one was brought to the Scottish Parliament in the autumn, would be that. I mean, the danger for Nicola Sturgeon in bringing this bill is that it seems an odd priority at a time when NHS waiting lists are going up rapidly, when pupils have obviously not recovered from the educational effects of homeschooling and the pandemic, and the criminal justice system delays. If she can turn that into a debate about whether the Scottish Parliament has the right to have this debate, that suits her a lot more. And secondly, one of the things that the Nationalists have done, which is one of the reasons how they've held their movement together, is to create these rallying points that basically says to everyone, "Oh, we must now win this fight rather than discussing, our own internal strategy." And a big debate between the UK government saying, "Oh, no, this debate in the Scottish Parliament is illegitimate, it's an infringement on reserve powers," would give Sturgeon that at a time when her own activists are scratchy. And just look at this dispute about what the SNP did or did not spend the money that was meant to be earmarked for a second independence campaign on. And so I think all of these reasons are why the UK government shouldn't rise to SNP provocations in the coming months.
Katie, is Boris Johnson going to find this actually quite a welcome break from Westminster politics, given that he has some pretty bad poll numbers recently, which, please, can you talk us through?
Yes, I will do. And I do think it's interesting. If you think back to the Scottish Parliament election campaign that we had, there was lots of talk at the time that Boris Johnson was not someone who'd be welcome to do a visit to Scotland, because things are so tense. The Scot Tories really worried about the impact Boris Johnson would have given his approval ratings there. Instead, I think the only man they wanted to see there was Rishi Sunak. So in a way, I think the fact that, yes, he is Prime Minister, but Boris Johnson is visiting as a sign of a less fraught situation, particularly now that election came and went without the SNP winning an outright majority. Now, I think if we move on to poll ratings across the UK, as you say, Cindy, we've had some interesting polling out this week of Tory members for the Conservative Home website. I think there were two eye-grabbing polls within that. The first was the Cabinet League table, which is the net satisfaction approbation ratings of the various cabinet ministers, and Boris Johnson has dropped quite heavily to the lower half. Still has a few ministers beneath him in terms of negative or net satisfaction lower scale, so Robert Jenrick, Gavin Williamson, Amanda Milling, the party chairman. But Rishi Sunak is very high, and both Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss, the international trade secretary, the ones with the highest approval ratings. Now, there's one other poll, which is the one I think which is perhaps raising more eyebrows, which is the next Tory leader. Now, there's not currently a vacancy, but Rishi Sunak tops that poll. And I think in a week where we're hearing some briefing, but also we're seeing the leak of travel letter written by Rishi Sunak that went to number 10 out in the Sunday Times. I think you're getting a lot of talk that the Chancellor is on manoeuvres. Now, there's strong denials that that's the case, but I think polls like this don't particularly help.
And James, it's not just Rishi Sunak, Boris Johnson, Nicola Sturgeon who are the key players here, because Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, is also in Scotland this week and he's visiting a wind farm. Can you talk us through what he's planning?
So I think for Keir Starmer, I mean, you have to have some sort of Labour revival in Scotland for a Labour majority, but I think even for Labour to be the largest party in a hung parliament. He also is very aware of the fact that if the polls tighten ahead of the next election, and we're going into it with the result uncertain, that the Tories will almost certainly do what they did to Ed Miliband to him, which is start asking, will you do a deal with the SNP? And this is a very difficult and this really did hurt Labour in 2015. And I think one of the things that Keir Starmer is trying to do is trying to preempt that attack. So this week he's made clear that he will not do any deal with the SNP either before or after a general election. And I mean, that's an attempt to address that question beforehand. I think there's an interesting question about Scottish Labour, which is, you know, everyone thought that Anas Sarwar had a particularly impressive Hollywood election campaign. You know, his personal ratings were very strong at the end of the campaign, but in part because of the tactical voting that went on, that didn't lead to a great result for Labour. And so I think the question is whether the Scottish Labour can kind of manage to rebuild themselves enough to win some parliamentary seats in Scotland at the next election, and whether Keir Starmer can find a way to handle this question of how he would behave in a hung parliament when it came to the SNP. And I think the line you will hear from him is, you know, no deals with the SNP. If they want to let the Tories in, that's up to them. I think Labour strategists have decided that that is the least worst line, because that's a line that can work for them, they think, in both England and England and Wales and Scotland. Because in Scotland, they can point to the fact that, you know, it was the SNP's performance in the 1979 No Confidence vote, but that was one of the things that led to Margaret Thatcher's election victory. And I think, you know, that I know that 1979 seems a long way away, but I think in the battle of between the SNP and Labour, I think you'll expect to hear Labour making that point in the next election when it comes to what would happen in a hung parliament.
And finally, Katie, while we're on the topic of Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon this week pushed quite hard for vaccinations to be opened up to teenagers, 16 and 17-year-olds, and now the JCVI has done that. So does she know that that was coming up, and is that why she staked her claim on that position? And is she right to do that?
I mean, I think she gave us a teaser as to what was going to happen within the next 24 hours. And the way she phrased it was the fact that she said that she understood we could expect there's likely to be announcements. So I think it was clearly coming from information she had access to rather than just hazarding a guess. It's something we've seen quite a few times during the pandemic, particularly in the early stages, where there was been frustration that you would have a meeting that Nicola Sturgeon would be at, and then Westminster politicians would be left surprised every time it happened that Nicola Sturgeon would hold a press conference before Boris Johnson had managed to get up to the podium to make his own announcement. So I think that's a general theme and perhaps one to just to expect. But I think on-child vaccination is interesting, because I do think the mood music from the Scottish government is much more, positive, or generally speaking, open to this idea. Whereas I think with the UK government, with the Westminster government, it's been a bit more muted. And I think that's partly because there is some debate in government across cabinet, also amongst some Public Health England, as to the wisdom of vaccinating children in terms of how young you go with the age groups. But the strong suggestion we have this week from the Deputy Chief Medical Officer, Jonathan Van Tam, is that ultimately this is heading one way, so younger age groups could soon be added, so you could see the over 12s, and I think that's definitely one to watch.
Katie and James, thanks for coming on. Now, vaccination may have been opened up to 16-year-olds now, but the government is still facing a problem with lack of vaccine uptake in younger age groups. Now, in an attempt to woo 20-somethings after telling them they'll be banned from nightclubs and maybe their university lectures too, the government is promising discounts with Uber and Deliveroo as bribes. Will it work? I'm joined by Rory Sutherland, The Spectator's Wikiman columnist and vice chairman at the advertising agency Ogilvy. Rory, thanks for joining Spectator TV. What do you reckon? Do you think this is going to work?
They probably will work. I mean, I'm very sceptical generally about mainstream economics, but I wouldn't be so extreme as to say that incentives don't work. And those are, you know, those are fairly well targeted benefits. Other interesting behavioural scientists have also looked at the effect of lotteries on encouraging vaccination. Which is particularly if you design a lottery in such a way that you might end up being a winner, but knowing that you missed out through failing to vaccinate yourself. Those can also be quite powerful incentives to encourage people to take up a behaviour when they're what you might call on the margin.
Looking at this Uber and Deliveroo discount, I was a bit peeved that I've actually already had my first jab, I've got my second jab already booked in. Maybe I should have just delayed because my compliance is not really being rewarded.
There is always the risk that people game the system a little bit, or that people might actually hold off on vaccination waiting for a higher offer, rather like those people who refuse to sell their house to a developer on the grounds that if they're the last person resisting, they'll get the best price. I mean, I would argue that to some degree, it's fair to say of younger people that the impetus to be vaccinated if you're 25 is not the same impetus if you're 55. Mm. Because the likelihood of fatality is minimal from COVID. And so it's a more pro-social act becoming vaccinated if you're young, whereas if you're older, you could argue, well, to some degree, it's a selfish act. And therefore, the engagement of some sort of additional incentive or encouragement for young people. Of course, it won't work on complete anti-vaxxers. It only works at the margins. But then if you think about it, epidemiology kind of works at the margins. In other words, you don't need absolutely everybody to be vaccinated in order for this thing to be killed. You just need a sufficiently high proportion of people to effectively bring the R rate below one. And so it is important to say that, you know, if you can do something via persuasion, my favourite methods of approaching a problem are, first of all, try persuading people. Then if that fails, try bribing people. And only if that fails should you ever consider compulsion. Now, the strange thing about government is it's dominated by lawyers who occasionally take advice from economists. And government tends to approach things from legislation first, inducement or financial incentive second, and persuasion third. Now, whatever the relative merits of those three interventions, and as a kind of temperamental libertarian, I always favour persuasion wherever possible. I don't think it's difficult to make the case that government often approaches those things in the wrong order.
What do you think persuasion looks like in this context when it comes to COVID? I saw a German advert last year, for example, asking young people to stay at home during lockdown and comparing their efforts to their grandparents' efforts in Second World War and, you know, giving them sort of heroism to the thing.
I thought that was a brilliant thing, which, without mentioning the Second World War explicitly, okay, what it effectively said is, you know, in the past, and I have made that, funnily enough, I made that argument in a similar way beforehand. I said, Americans are going completely bananas about wearing masks. But I would argue that compared to being forced to fight in the Tet Offensive, okay, or go into the jungle being shot at by the Viet Cong, I would argue that wearing a mask down the high street of Moline is a relatively small inconvenience to have to endure. And the Germans took this same framing and did it rather brilliantly, which more or less said it had an elderly person effectively in the future talking about their service. And it was contrasting implicitly the difference between being forced to fight the Ivans on the Eastern Front and merely staying at home, ordering pizzas and watching Netflix. And it was incredibly funny and charming. And I think it was all the more persuasive because it was humorous. I think one of the things that the Germans managed to do, which interestingly maybe the British didn't, was partly to use a little bit of humour. Now, we know, you know, historically, humour is a magical means, just as music is, in a sense, for generating an emotional state without some of the negatives that arise if you try and use the sheer brute force of reason. And you can make points humorously, which are then accepted, which would be rejected if you tried to make them in deadly seriousness. And so I thought the Germans deserve a significant commendation for how they handled it. And it seemed to have worked. I think it is important to remember that many, many things, and I'd include that things like adoption of electric cars, okay? We don't need everybody to adopt electric cars. Forcing people or bribing people to adopt electric cars unfairly punishes a lot of people who, by dint of their circumstances, can't or won't adopt them. So persuasion should always be the first mode of intervention, simply because it harvests the low-hanging fruit. And sometimes the low-hanging fruit is all you need. You know, I've argued for ages as just an environmental policy. Look, if you encourage people to put their tumble dryers and washing machines on later at night, okay, that will actually reduce carbon emissions, simply because the UK is kind of nuclear powered, or powered heavily by renewables at 10 o'clock in the evening in a way that it isn't at 5 o'clock. Now, if you try and make that compulsory, or you use the price mechanism, what happens to people who work the night shift? They can't do it. You don't want them leaving their house with a tumble dryer on. What happens to people who live in a flat and their washing machine is immediately above their neighbour's bedroom, which means it's going to hit the spin cycle at 1 o'clock in the morning? Those people can't do it. Now, the great thing with persuasion is if you've got a good reason, you can advance that reason and you're now immune or freed from the obligation. The second you start using economic incentives or legal directives, that nuance gets completely lost. And you try and design legislation for everybody, which in some cases ends up working for nobody.
Mm. And we've only really seen that persuasion. You know, you've had people like Gareth Southgate making a short video asking young people to get vaccinated. But I've not really heard anything else really in that persuasion side. On the other hand, we have heard about vaccine passports being coming in for nightclubs under the thought that under 30s go to nightclubs and this is what's going to get them to get jabbed. What do you make of that? We had Sir Mark Walpott, who is Patrick Vallance's predecessor in the chief scientific advisor role, on Spectator TV recently, and he was calling that a nudge. I mean, it feels more like a shove.
Yes, the vaccine passport, of course, it's ambiguous in a way, in that, you know, I mean, the way I describe myself is a default libertarian. I don't accept the idea that there aren't coordination problems. I don't accept the idea that there isn't a need for central. And I don't object, you know, to put it very simply, I don't object to people painting lines in the car park. OK, you know, there are certain, you know, if you're an extreme libertarian, you'd say it's interfering with my right to park at the diagonal. I don't object to that kind of thing. You know, painting white lines on the road is a nudge, if you like, okay? And, you know, even Deirdre McCloskey, who's more libertarian, I think, than I am, argues that there's a large informational role that government can play, which needn't involve any kind of compulsion at all. Now, where does the issuing of a passport, where it's up to the private sector to determine whether they require that passport or not, where does that sit? Now, to me personally, and I admit this is very, very subjective, to me that's relatively uncontroversial if the passport is being policed by private entities who simply say, sorry, it's our restaurant. If you're not prepared to do this, you can't come in. When it becomes employers, for example, or academic institutions, you know, no vax, no lecture, that gets a bit more contentious. Because you can argue, well, you don't necessarily have free choice there. You know, you can't suddenly switch university according to their vaccine policy. And so it's complicated. I generally regard the imposition of vaccine rules by private institutions as broadly speaking acceptable. It gets more contentious, if you like, when it starts to be imposed in areas where I would argue that. Mask wearing, you know, I don't really understand the massive dissent over masks, because to me, you know, there are plenty of inconvenient things like wearing underpants that I do really, you know, not necessarily for my own self-interest, but simply to avoid alarming other people. And I would place mask wearing in the field of courtesy, which is even if you don't believe in them. And I think they do work, by the way. You know, I think at some level they undoubtedly work. But even if you don't believe in them, some people do. And it's deeply, you know, discourteous to elderly people who may be alarmed by someone wandering around the shops without a mask. I think it's simply an act of courtesy to other people. And, you know, it also sits within, I think, you know, the reasonable realm of the precautionary principle. You know, well, this might work, and generally the cost-benefit thing looks fairly high. When you're demanding people are vaccinated who are young, for example, and there are side effects to the vaccine among the young. You know, they're not particularly unpleasant for the most part, but they're not negligible. I'm getting a bit more uncomfortable there, and I might also raise the question, well, what if, to be honest, it isn't necessary to hit 100%?
And Rory, just on that vaccine passport point, some people have been saying that because it's coming in September, not immediately, that actually all of it is just a ploy for people to get vaccinated, and come September, these passports may not even come into place. But what I wonder about that is that isn't it quite a hit on the government's credibility to do that kind of U-turn, to kind of dangle this kind of threat over young people and then rescind it as if they never wanted to do it in the first place? I mean, that credibility hit, surely in the minds of people, is actually not insignificant.
Well, it's a very interesting question, isn't it? Which is, how should we react to legislation which is really exists for its signalling value rather than as an actual restraint on behaviour? So it acts as an accelerant. It encourages people to act fast. It's equivalent to only four seats left at this price, which is, you might as well do it now because you'll have to do it ultimately. Now, as you might expect, working in the advertising industry and with a strong interest in kind of behavioural science, legislation actually quite a lot of legislation in a way works that way. I mean, we don't impose speed limits rigorously, okay? We very rarely fine people for going 73 miles an hour. And so legislation which exists in potential but isn't necessarily enforced can have a value, because it essentially, it might accelerate a behaviour. It might make corporate decision making easier, because you can say this is going to be a legal requirement in 5 years' time, so we might as well start acting now. All our competitors will be doing this. So in solving coordination problems, laws which act to send a message rather than to actually necessarily be enforced, I would argue, are actually, from a libertarian point of view, fairly desirable in a funny kind of way, because they solve the coordination problem without necessarily limiting liberty. And so the way I always phrase it is, I'm not a pure libertarian, but I'm glad such people exist, because I think that mentality plays an essential component part in looking at decision-making over how government intervenes with the populace. I'm not massively sympathetic towards anti-maskers, because it seems to be a very, very small price to pay, and it seems to be a slightly deranged fear. Anti-vaxxers, I would seek, if possible, because, you know, there are potential arguments against universal vaccination. And anti-vaxxers, in that case, I would seek to find an accommodation with them.
Rory Sutherland, thanks for joining Spectator TV. And finally, is it fair for a trans woman to compete against women in sports? That whole debate has been reignited by the participation of the 43-year-old Laurel Hubbard in women's weightlifting. She transitioned a decade ago, but did her physique still give her an unfair advantage over her female peers? To discuss this, I'm joined now by Suzanne Moore, the Telegraph columnist who left The Guardian after writing about transgender issues. Suzanne, welcome to Spectator TV. To start with, do you think it was fair that Laurel Hubbard was competing in the women's category?
It's such a difficult question. I think Laurel's inclusion has really brought this stuff to the fore. And there are a whole number of issues here about Laurel Hubbard, not just about gender, actually. I think the fact that Laurel Hubbard was twice the age of the other competitors, the situation where she took the place of a much younger woman for New Zealand, I really not sure how much this has done for the argument that we should include trans people in sports. I think we should include trans people in sport, but there are questions of which sports and how do we make it fair. I mean, people have not made much of a fuss about Quinn, who was a medalist in the Olympic football, who is a trans man. That hasn't grabbed much attention at all because Quinn was competing in the female category. So it's not a question of just trying to pick on Laurel Hubbard. It's a question of trying to work out what actually is fair. And I do think sports is one of the issues where this whole debate about sex and gender, which can seem very, very abstract to people, becomes really visible. You know, what is a man? What is a woman? What are our bodies the same? Can we actually change sex? And it makes those questions really, really tangible to people.
Yeah, and you make the point that different sports, do you think that we should have different rules for different sports depending on what we're measuring as excellence?
Yeah, I was sort of joking once, but I put on Twitter, you know, if you want to be equal, just get on a horse and learn to ride it. And I would say now the same about a BMX bike since Charlotte Worthington, you know, did that amazing stuff. Clearly there are sports where strength, muscle mass, bone density are involved, and weightlifting does appear to be one of them. There are other sports where perhaps, you know, it is a more level playing field. I think I'm not sure we can just have one rule for every sport.
Yeah. You know? That's an interesting amount of nuance there, because obviously some things, as you say, are more strength-based. But for someone like Laurel Hubbard, you know, she did fail her lifts three times, all three of them. So she actually didn't do that well. And for weightlifting, there are weight categories depending on the lifter themselves. So some people might say, actually, when it comes to these categories, she doesn't seem to have that much of an advantage because of the way that she did, and also because of the way that the sport is already categorised. What do you think about that?
Well, the fact that she failed can be used, I suppose, to say, well, she didn't have the advantage. But I think, I mean, I'm no great expert on weightlifting, but when I started to read about it, people were surprised that she was chosen because the average age of a weightlifter at their peak is usually early 20s, and then they sort of decline. So had Laurel been competing in any category of men, she just wouldn't have qualified at all. So to choose because of her gender identity to compete with women at that age seemed to me a really very strange sort of proving of a point somehow. And it did look a lot like, I wrote this, so I have to, you know, and I do think this, it did look a lot like male entitlement there. And I don't know if you saw, Cindy, the reaction of the three medalists when they were interviewed yesterday.
It was a historic night here with Laurel Hubbard competing as the first openly transgender in a individual event. And I was wondering, you know, what you felt about that and what you felt that it took place in your sport.
No, thank you.
It felt very much like they were not happy, and some people read it as, well, they've been told not to say anything. I read it as their silence said a lot about what they thought out there. So,
well, Susanna, as you know, is a very tricky topic for people who do choose to comment on it, so I can imagine that they didn't want to wade into that at all, regardless of their opinions.
I can imagine and also, I mean, these are people, aren't they, who trained for years and years and years, and this issue of unfairness in sport, we have in all sorts of, you know, doping, and it's something that I don't think any of us can be completely decided or expert on, because the science itself is divided. But there does seem to be a clear direction now that even the IOC are going in, which is to rewrite the rules by which Laurel Hubbard qualified, which was this measurement of testosterone. They now think it's too high, they may change it, because the argument from some doctors and scientists is that if you've gone through male puberty, you will always have another kind of advantage of being able to build muscle and bone density. And so just the measure of testosterone is not adequate, really. Mm.
And Laurel Hubbard did, and having transitioned at the age of 33, not any younger.
Yeah. So, I mean, I have real sympathy for... I mean, there are certain athletes we know, like Caster Semenya, who were born the way they were born, with naturally high testosterone levels. I don't think I've ever tried to cheat, or that's just the way she is. You know, this is a grey area. It's not just about ideology, it's something that, in terms of fairness between men and women, we need to work out.
And Suzanne, you mentioned unfairness in sport, but, you know, isn't sport inherently unfair on a biological level? So, for example, someone with my height, I can never be a sprinter because my legs are just not long enough. But we accept that's okay, and I would still be competing in a women's category, and we only have male and female categories. So there's some level of biological unfairness that we accept. So I guess the difficulty is, where do you draw the line, and what biology do you draw the line at?
I don't think we know where the lines lie, and I think the other issue is that there are some sports that are clearly dangerous. Say, for instance, I would say rugby, which may involve traumatic head injury, as we know. And I think then you have a duty of care, really, to protect women who want to play rugby, trans women, whoever it is. I think we, as a society, that's what we should be looking at. I think the other issue that's come up during the Olympics so strongly this time is the absolute, you know, mental sort of pressure that people are under, and that they're prepared to talk about now much more openly the mental health issues. And in a way, I mean, Laurel Hubbard, to me, put herself in a tremendously pressurised, difficult situation. It's quite hard to fathom, really, because I don't know whether she was there to try and kind of represent trans people or just herself, because she's not said very much, and she's said to be a very quiet and private person. She's not really told us very much about it. So... She's put herself under a lot of pressure, not won a medal. I guess when it comes to the next Olympics, which, you know, in a few years, I imagine the science will have changed. I think it will be different. I mean, some people are arguing, I've read people arguing for a kind of third space almost for trans athletes.
Do you think that would be a good idea?
Again, I think it really depends on the sport. I mean, I do think that there are clearly sports where this kind of physicality is not so relevant. I mean, we know women jockeys can beat men. You know what I mean? We know in cycling, and there are, so I think it really, really depends. On sports that are based, I guess, on size and strength, and rugby and weightlifting would be two of those. It's a bit like what you're saying. You're not going to be an Olympian because you're not
only,
tall enough.
Only because of my legs, though. Not
that's the only reason.
Yeah, no, exactly.
There now. I know. I realise that.
I'm always
there. Me too. If only I wasn't short and fat, but never mind. So there are these, yeah, like you say, there's these inherent differences, aren't there? And then there's these issues about what hormone... what hormones do and how long people have to take hormones for to be accepted as the gender that they identify with, and whether that then mitigates the advantages that they have.
Some
doctors think not.
Suzanne Moore, thanks for joining Spectator TV. And that's it for this week. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe to The Spectator's YouTube channel. Just click the subscribe button at the bottom of this video and the bell icon to make sure you never miss an episode. Thanks for watching, and do join us again next week.